challenges whenever you're ready.
Good morning. Carolyn Fuentes for Carlos Pineda Ramos. May it please the court. I have some new information that I have to start with this morning. I'm not certain whether the court is aware, but Mr. Gay of the U.S. Attorney's Office has confirmed as of this morning that Mr. Pineda has been deported to Honduras. So he's no longer in the country. In view of that new development, we would amend our request for relief in this case. Ordinarily, and what we have requested in our opening brief is vacation of the sentence and remand for resentencing, but since he's not in the country, that's unlikely to be possible. It is possible, but unlikely. So we would ask the court to use its authority under 28 United States Code 2106 to modify the judgment in this case, should Mr. Pineda prevail, to reflect that his supervised release term should be 1 year instead of 3 years. Because if we do prevail, the statutory maximum supervised release term, which he is under, is going to be 1 year instead of three. And now I'll go on to the question presented, unless the court has any questions about that.
Okay. So that's the only relief that he would be entitled to under these circumstances?
Under this court's precedent, I think so. Well, I'm sorry, I back up. Yes, he's already served his prison term, so really there's nothing that can be done about that. But he is under, if he wins, if he prevails, he's under a supervised release term that exceeds his statutory maximum.
Why don't we each side can send us a letter of a reasonable length on any particulars that are caused by this new change in circumstances.
So we will do so, Your
Honor. Get those in within the next a few days would be helpful.
Yeah. Okay, we will do so.
How will the supervised relief, the period of supervised supervision, be pertinent to him since he is out of the country? And I assume he can come back except illegally.
Yes,
he's going to illegally enter the country again and run into supervised supervision. If he comes in illegally, the only way that happened, he'd come back into custody and he'd be charged again.
Well, he's still under the conditions of supervised release, whether or not he's in the country. It's non-reporting release, but the conditions still exist. And so I will address that.
Well, how is he monitored for?
He's not. It's unsupervised release, but the conditions still apply. And I think, I'll give just a quick answer.
What conditions are you talking about?
Oh, conditions that he support his family. I mean, I can go and look through the judgment, and I will put those in any supplemental letter that I file. But that he support his family, that he refrain from excessive use of alcohol, all the general
standard. But doesn't he have to report to a probation officer or something?
If he's in the country, he does. If he's out of the country.
And that's still, even though he's out of the country, that condition is still there, right?
I don't think so, and I think not, because, and I'll have to look at the specifics of the judgment. But let me point out, Your Honor, that, and again, I will put this in the in our supplemental letter, but the Supreme Court in United States versus Campos Serrano, 404 U.S. 293, at 294 footnote 2, says that a defendant is still under a sentence of probation and subject to its conditions even if he is out of the country. So, again, I will follow up on that.
So if he has the wrong sentence here, would this affect him in a future sentence if he committed another criminal act?
It could, depending on when that occurred. If he committed a criminal act while the three-year term still existed, then, yes, it would increase his sentencing guidelines. As for the question presented substantively in this case, it is whether Mr. Pineda's North Carolina conviction for breaking and entering is a felony for purposes of Guideline Section 2L1.2.
He's already served his sentence, and the prior felony was to enhance the sentence that he's already served, and the only remnant of that sentence left is a supervised probation. It's a period of supervision, and the man's in Guatemala not subject to supervision. I find it bit of a stretch to say this case is not moot, but
again, Your Honor, I cite the Supreme Court and I'll be happy to address it.
I don't read that last, I don't understand that. I'm not sure I understand that last quote in the Supreme Court to speak to this situation.
Let me also.
Man's out of the country. He's been deported by the United States government.
Let me point out also this court's opinion in United States versus Lares Meraz, which is 452 Federal Reporter 3rd at 352. And in that opinion, this court analyzed whether the existence of a supervised release term for a defendant who had been deported rendered his whether his case was moot because he'd been taken out of the country, and this court said no. With respect to the North Carolina prior, I'm sorry, Your Honor, have I not answered the question?
Yes, ma'am, you did. I just haven't encountered that before.
Okay.
It still strikes me as unusual.
All right. I'll keep that in mind when I prepare the supplemental response. The North Carolina, we argue that the prior North Carolina breaking and entering conviction is not a felony under the Supreme Court opinions in United States versus Rodriguez and the more recent opinion in Carachuri-Resendo versus Holder. The North Carolina structured sentencing statute is fairly unique. I've appended the statute as it applies in this case to the opening brief. And what the statute does is that it has a chart, a sentencing chart, but this is statutory. It's not guidelines. It's not analogous to what we do in federal court. The vertical axis has the offense classification. The horizontal axis has the prior record level of the defendant. And where those two axes intersect on the chart, there is a cell which specifies minimum and maximum terms of imprisonment. In this case, within that cell, there are three different types of offenses: an aggravated offense, a mitigated offense, or the regular offense, which is subject to the presumptive range of sentencing. In this case, Mr. Pineda did not plead guilty to an aggravated offense, and so his minimum sentence was 8 to 10 months. Now, on that chart, I think it's you can see it at page 3 of the appendix to the opening brief. On that chart, when there is a minimum sentence of 8 to 10 months, the maximum that can be imposed is somewhere between 10 and 12 months. The way it works is the sentencing court chooses the minimum. In Mr. Pineda's case in particular, the district court chose a sentence of 9 months. The second part of the chart, the next chart below the horizontal and vertical axis, shows that having chosen a sentence of 9 months, the court was limited to a maximum of 11 months as a maximum imprisonment.
And that's really limited. It's not a guideline. It's a strict rule for them.
Correct. It is a strict rule, and I've cited the North Carolina statute in my brief, case in my brief, which says the court has no discretion to go above that maximum. Now, the district court erred in this case by adopting the Fourth Circuit's reasoning in United States versus Harp to decide that the minimum and maximum terms that applied in determining what the maximum possible sentence was were those of the hypothetical defendant, the defendant with the worst possible prior record level and the most aggravating of circumstances. And when you look at it that way, and that's also the approach that the government has taken, and the government sees the maximum as 25 to 30 months for that hypothetical defendant. But that is wrong under both Rodriguez and Carachuri-Resendo. In United States versus Rodriguez, the Supreme Court was tasked with deciding whether the defendant was subject to an armed career criminal enhancement by virtue of a prior drug conviction in Washington State. Now, a prior drug conviction, the general offense was punishable by up to 5 years, but if the accused had a prior drug conviction, then he was subject to 10 years. And the accused, of course, argued that he was only subject to 5 years, and the government wanted him to be subject to 10 years. So Rodriguez says when an accused's prior record level affects the statutory maximum sentence, that prior record level must be considered. And that's what the court did. And in Rodriguez, the court makes clear that if the government wants to say, wants to impose that enhancement and wants to say you were subject to 10 years, the government has to show that he was actually convicted of that recidivist offense. And so what the court in Rodriguez said is look to the record of conviction to see what the defendant was actually convicted of. And that's important in our case as well, because 2L1.2 says that the defendant is subject to an enhanced punishment for a prior felony conviction if the defendant has a conviction. So we have to see what Mr. Pineda was actually convicted of. And when we look at the judgment in this case, which was attached as Exhibit E to the pre-sentence report addendum, it says minimum sentence 9 months, maximum sentence 11 months. And even if you went a little way into hypothetical territory, the maximum he could have faced under the chart was 12 months had the district court chosen the max, and the court has discretion to choose the minimum. The top of the minimum was 10 months. If the court had chosen the top of the minimum, it would have been limited to 12 months. So either way, he was not actually subject to a sentence of imprisonment of more than 1 year. Carachuri really just affirms that. Carachuri-Rosendo versus Holder considered whether a second or subsequent drug conviction, which in theory, for the hypothetical defendant, could be punished more severely, whether that was sufficient to make out an aggravated felony for Carachuri. And the Supreme Court said no. In Carachuri, as in this case, we're trying to determine the offense for which the defendant was convicted. And when you have to look at the offense for which the defendant was convicted, you've got to see the punishment that the defendant actually faced. Now, because it is the defendant's conviction that triggers it, you've got to, the punishment faced by a hypothetical defendant will not do. And Mr. Pineda was not convicted of an aggravated offense, which would have raised the statutory maximum. And I think it's interesting that in this case, the government argues that Rodriguez supports its position, and that's the same argument the government made in Carachuri. But when you're looking at that conviction, once again, you have to see what the particular defendant in that case actually faced, because you're looking at whether he was convicted of an offense punishable by a year or more. And let me make a final comment on the significance, really, of Carachuri-Rosendo for the decision in this case. I discovered in preparing for this case that in the Fourth Circuit, defendants have been challenging that finding in HARP upon which this court relied. And there were several petitions for certiorari pending on that issue, whether you look at the individual or the hypothetical most aggravated defendant. There were several petitions for cert pending when Carachuri was decided. And they were all granted, vacated, and remanded and sent back to the district, to the courts of appeals for consideration in the light of Carachuri. In a case called United States versus Simmons, the Fourth Circuit just heard argument in December on the question of whether Carachuri-Rosendo changes its interpretation as set forth in HARP. And I would just also note, and again, I probably will put this in a supplemental letter as well, and I apologize for the lateness of it, but the North Carolina Advocates for Justice, which is a state attorney's organization, filed an amicus brief in that Simmons case. It's available at 2010 Westlaw, or 2010 Westlaw, 408-4562. And that outlines, in much more detail than I have, how North Carolina law actually works. And so it's a very helpful tool for looking at how this applies. The court has no further questions.
I assume that any opinion that we would write on the merits here could be pretty narrowly drawn to deal only with the particulars of the North Carolina statute. It is, in fact, unique, isn't it?
Correct.
I don't mean to suggest you should know the laws of all the 50 states, but as far as we know, it's an unusual situation that wouldn't have any general applicability.
I haven't seen any, I guess, range schemes that are close to North Carolina, except I will say there are some similarities in Kansas. And I'm sorry, I can't remember. One of the cases the government relied on might have been Jones. I'm not certain. They deal with Kansas, and it is somewhat similar. But other than that, no.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Fuentes, you've saved time for rebuttal. Mr. Gay.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'd like to initially begin on the concept of mootness. This court, in an opinion called Rosenbaum-Alanis, a published decision from 2007, 483 F3rd 381, specifically addressed this exact factual pattern and has held that the case is moot.
Why is it that we're learning about this today?
It's unfortunate, Your Honor, but in preparing for this case, I noticed the sentence length. I put in an inquiry through DHS, and I literally received the copy of the deportation order, which you received this morning, at 10 minutes to 9 this morning.
When was he deported?
In November, Your Honor.
Oh, in November?
November 10th. And it is unfortunate. That's all I can say is that I diligently worked as soon as I became aware that it appeared to me that something was amiss, and as I said, at 10 minutes to 9 this morning, I was provided a copy via email.
What conditions could may re-enter the country?
Without the permission of the Attorney General, it's impossible without entering illegally.
If he did,
what is the supervision that is now being we're down to consist of?
Basically, and I have the judgment. Essentially, when you are in most 1326 cases involving situations where you're sentenced and likely to be returned to Mexico, the district courts impose what is referred to as non-reporting supervised release. And so it's quite common that defendants essentially are returned to Mexico, and of course they don't report to a probation officer. And whether they comply with not drinking alcohol or associating with criminals or supporting their families is really moot. It just doesn't take place. The only consequence is if he illegally reenters, of course, and in which case, you know, it's completely within his own control whether that contingent event were to occur.
But he would have a sentence enhanced if he illegally reentered and he was on his supervised release, even if he wasn't supposed to still be on supervised release.
In theory, you would get 2 points for being on supervised release at the time of committing the new offense of illegal reentry, let's say, because he cannot commit an offense in the United States except for having first committed an illegal reentry. But getting back to Rosenbaum-Alanis, it distinguishes the case cited by Ms. Fuentes, which was Lara's Meraz, and the difference there is that in this, the court specifically says, because the defendant has been deported to the Republic of Mexico and is legally unable without permission of the Attorney General to reenter the United States, to be present for a resentencing proceeding as required by Rule 43, there is no relief we are able to grant him, and his appeal is moot. And so then they go on to say, Rosenbaum argues that Lara's Meraz compels a contrary conclusion, and they reject that. And basically they say that this is a situation that is quite different because the defendant has been removed to Mexico, that the case is actually moot because no resentencing can occur in which relief can be granted. Now, of course, Ms. Fuentes has asked that this court would exercise its power to modify the judgment on its own, but in fact, should this court reach the issue of his sentence, I think you would have no choice but to vacate and remand for resentencing, which is impossible in this case because the defendant is not present. And so I believe that regardless of this panel is bound by Rosenbaum-Alanis, which is specifically on point, and obviously Ms. Fuentes, I believe, is citing to a Supreme Court case which may have, I believe, predates Rosenbaum-Alanis, but this court has been, and you can look and see that there's probably 25 cases which have followed Rosenbaum-Alanis under these exact facts. I may be exaggerating, but numerous cases have been remanded, basically found to be moot, following this decision.
So you would say that the that the appeal would be dismissed as moot?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that right? It wouldn't affect the judgment of sentence in any way, just the
appeal would be.
In your view. Well, just be sure that, you know, that you give us a letter specifying exactly what action the Department of Justice believes should be taken. And
absolutely. And so, turning to the issue of the North Carolina sentencing scheme, obviously the analysis set forth in our brief, we stand by. We don't believe that, in fact, anything has changed. In fact, Karachuri is really quite distinguishable.
Do you agree that you can't use the sentence of a hypothetical defendant?
Yes, in the context of what Karachuri held, I absolutely agree. But to the extent that this is a situation where, under the guidelines, it speaks to the concept a felony is defined as an offense punishable. And there's a reason why that language is used. And in Karachuri, that was a situation where you had two prior state misdemeanor offenses, and under the federal statutory scheme, the government would have had to have sought a recidivist enhancement under the CSA, Controlled Substances Act, in order to treat those as a felony, and the court said, well, you didn't file one, so therefore it can't be one. In this case, however, it's actually just quite different, it seems to me. Here, the defendant fell into a scheme in which his offense is punishable by a term of up to 25 to 30 months, and that is what we argued in the brief. As we set forth in our brief, in opinion after opinion after opinion, the courts have rejected analyzing whether something is a felony based on the characteristics of the defendant, and instead, in fact, looking to the statutory language and the statutory maximum. And Ms. Fuentes is quite correct. The Supreme Court did GVR at least two cases, and they are reconsidering those cases. I would point out that in the interim, there's probably six or seven lower court opinions which have rejected applying Karachuri and have followed the law as it currently stands in the Fifth Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, although they were probably bound to do so. I would point out one rather, United States versus Etheridge, which is at, it's a district court from the North, from federal district court from North Carolina. It's at Westlaw, 2010, Westlaw 4974559. And it provides a very cogent explanation of why that district court did not apply Karachuri and, in fact, followed North Carolina law. Ultimately, I think that whether this court waits to see how the Fourth Circuit, obviously North Carolina, they would be in the best position, obviously, to, as the district court observed in sentencing the defendant, it followed the Fourth Circuit law because it's North Carolina is in the Fourth Circuit. And maybe perhaps if they change the analysis, this court could look at that. But clearly at this point, it's all speculative. And it may be that Karachuri is found not to have any applicability at all. I certainly see arguments on both sides. I'm not saying that you couldn't construe, perhaps, this hypothetical defendant argument. But it flies in the face of a long-standing set of cases which have really focused on the statutory definition of felony as opposed to a characteristic-based definition of what constitutes a felony offense. And the language punishable means just that, punishable. It's a scheme. And so in this case, I don't contest that the district court doesn't have any discretion, and maybe that is the critical factor in terms of whether it, having chosen 9 months, the maximum could be 11. But it does seem to me that the cases are clearly arguable on both sides. I think we've put together a fairly cogent argument as to why.
Well, it may be arguable on both sides, but I was on the panel that got reversed in Karachuri. So a defendant with a level 3 criminal history with no possibility of an aggravated sentence could not get a term exceeding 1 year, a hypothetical defendant in that situation.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, the language of the definition says punishable, which is different than the situation of the Controlled Substances Act that Carachuri addressed. I'm not sure, I'll be quite frank, how this is going to come down, and obviously this court is going to have the opportunity to make this decision. I don't believe this is the case where you're going to probably do it, because I do believe that the deportation of the defendant has rendered the case moot. However, should this court decide to reach the merits, ultimately that's going to be a decision, and perhaps what the Fourth Circuit ends up doing. They have not taken the case en banc, however, which is somewhat interesting. So, if there are no further questions, I will yield back the balance of my time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Gay. Ms. Fuentes?
I just have a couple of brief comments. First, I think it's very important to remember that we're not dealing just with the word punishable here. And in fact, the government's argument with respect to punishable, and punishable is important, and you have to focus on it, that's the argument the government made and lost in Carachuri. And in fact, in Carachuri, the government, Supreme Court says the government is arguing as though punishable is the only word at issue here. But that's not the only word at issue here. We also have to determine whether the defendant was convicted of an offense punishable as a felony under the Controlled Substances Act. And so you do look at punishable, but you have to look at whether he was convicted. And in this case, we have the same thing. The word is conviction instead of convicted. I think it is basically the same thing. But under Guideline 2L1.2, a defendant gets the enhancement for a prior felony.
What relief do you seek from this court?
To modify the judgment of conviction to reflect that the supervised release term is 1 year, which would be the statutory maximum, should we prevail in our argument, instead of the 3 years that are now provided.
That doesn't require resentencing.
Pardon?
That doesn't require resentencing.
Not under 28 U.S.C. 2106. I mean, that statute gives this court broad authority to modify the amendment, basically to serve the ends of justice. And if Mr. Pineda is asking for that, I think that is perfectly fine to give them. If you vacated the judgment, he'd have to be resentenced. And I noticed that Mr. Gay doesn't cite any authority except for Rosenbaum Alanis for the proposition that you can't do anything else. But in Rosenbaum Alanis, it has to be remembered that there the defendant asked for, just as we initially asked for, vacating the sentence and remanding for resentencing. And they even argued things like, well, you know, we could get a waiver, which is also a possibility. But the court in Rosenbaum Alanis said that is too speculative, and we're not, since we cannot give you the relief of vacating the sentence and remanding it for reconsideration, we're going to dismiss this case as moot. And
you'll deal with that in your letter, I assume, and how the Rosenbaum case did, according to Mr. Gay, distinguish the case
correct.
That you had cited.
We will. And I really don't have any other comments to make except that punishable argument, which I view as the pinpoint of the government, is just wrong under Carachuri.
All right.
If there are no other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Fuentes.
Thank you.
Your case is under submission. Last case for today, United States versus Liege.